While we were on holiday this summer, we stayed with, for part of the time, with my sister-in-law and her husband, and my wife's sister, and her husband. And Andrew has got a doctorate in computer programming and is an executive with IBM, the computer firm. And he had been on a time management course. IBM send all their executives at a certain stage in their career structure on time management. And we were browsing through some of the literature that he had and looking at the very specialized diary system. And then I left my wife behind and went off to see my mother and father for several days while Lorna stayed with her sister. They stay just outside Newcastle. When I came back, my wife, of all people, was raving about this and said, "This is just what you need. You're such a shambles, an absolute hopeless shambles. This is what you need." So I wrote away for the information and got back this lovely wee brochure. I sent one to Mr. Still. That side was me, you see. You maybe can't see it from here, but it's a chap who's harassed and his tie is all a mess and his desk is a shambles and so are his shelves behind. And after you've been on a time management course, you end up like that. You really do. Now, you don't believe me, but you really do. Well, I wrote away for it and discovered it cost, with VAT added in, £300 for 2 days. And so you have to be creative. I wrote and said... You have to be creative. So I wrote away and asked if they gave a discount for clergymen paying themselves. And they gave me it free. I had to buy the hardware, but everything else I got free. Well, now, I've got 5 reasons, which are a very good number of reasons to have for speaking on this subject today. And the first, I suppose, really isn't a reason, it's an apology. It's an apology to older men who've been in the ministry much longer than most of us, and they have been through the hard slog of seeing a church founded. And they've been through the hard slog of having to do so much of the administrative work themselves, and they've reached the stage now where they have their congregation well trained and they are able to give themselves almost, I don't think in this life ever wholly, but almost to the ministry of the word and to prayer. Now, many of us, it's going to be years before we can do that. But I am aware that there are some of you here who will listen to this with some amusement, such as Mr. Still Entertainment. He's long past the stage of time management. His whole life is kind of managed in that way, and he doesn't need this sort of thing, I'm sure. So my apology to you, sir, and to those who have got your experience. But secondly, there is a distinct lack of any kind of training in this area in the colleges today. I'm very, very conscious of it. Particularly as I befriend younger men and see them living through what I've lived through for about 20 years now since I left theological college, a complete lack of any direction in practical theology. Now, I may be wrong, and if I am wrong, just shout out and heckle. I'll not mind that at all. But in my very slender experience, very few of those teaching practical theology have ever run a heavy parish, far less 4 or 5. I think that very often their standpoint is typified by a College of Education lecturer in Callander Park who, in a staff room in a school where I am chaplain, was asked, "What will you do, Francis, when Callander Park closes down? Will you go back to teaching?" To which he answered quite blandly and without thought, "Oh, I couldn't do that. I'm too out of touch." Yes, true, that's not a funny, that's true. So I think that younger men would be helped. A third reason is that the way things are going in the Church of Scotland, as Tom pointed out the first afternoon, was it, the way things are going in the Church of Scotland, more and more men are going to end up with more and more churches and a greater administrative load, especially in the early years of their ministry. And then a fourth reason for taking this subject is my own struggle to survive in the ministry has been a very hard one. And I have to confess that I have lost out in many aspects of the ministry, kind of work that we all long to spend more and more time on. I have lost out on the spiritual side in many weeks and months and years of my life because I've been defeated in this logistical side or mechanical side. And then the fifth reason is perhaps the most important of all. It is that we may not neglect the running of our churches. That dreary work of running the church that Tom referred to, we may not neglect it. We are living in a society where people are used to the structures of managerial organization, and many of our elders will unconsciously look on us as administrators. And while we are to work towards shedding a great deal of that kind of work, that is not going to happen overnight. It is going to take years and years. And you have to begin with the work that you inherit and all the attitudes that you inherit from your previous minister, and you can't change them overnight. You have to be patient and accept the thing. And I am quite convinced that if we do our parish work well, that we will slowly earn the confidence and respect of our people. They looked at Daniel's life and could find nothing in him apart from his faith in God. Joseph was the same, absolutely meticulous. Now, some of you, I've got three themes really, and the first is the brain. Some of you will have been taught, and I do apologize to those of you who've done psychology, you'll have been taught a little bit of how the brain works, and you'll have a good understanding of the various processes of thought, memory, analytical thinking, synthetic thinking, and so on. But a few of us have been until recently unaware of these insights. I say recently because it's really only in the past two decades that there has been an enormous burst of research. I think 100,000 PhDs a year now on the brain, an enormous burst of knowledge about the brain and its working, an enormous amount of clinical research has been done. And time management really begins with understanding a little about the brain functions and the way in which we can try and maximize on the brain's potential. The wrong use of the brain leads to certain things, according to the modern research. You get tired too easily, and a very little knocks you out. You don't read fast enough, but you drag your way through what you're reading. You get headaches, and I know a little bit about that, whether they're tension headaches or they're migraine headaches, and those two are quite distinct and quite different. You get digestive problems and ulcers. You become quick-tempered. Oh, no, you don't. Ask your wife. You become quick-tempered and you find self-control difficult. Just try yourself when you're on the way back from the hospitals and you're in a traffic jam. You start quarrelling. You forget what you're supposed to do, and you find it difficult to concentrate in your study. Now, at least five of those was true of me in a very significant way. And so when the course that I attended at the beginning of October, when this course began, and it began on these lines, I was all ears. And I thought, I have been sent here. This is me. I'm in a bad way. And then watching the faces of others, and there were managers from Rolls-Royce and Hewlett-Packard and IBM and so on, watching the faces of others, I saw that they were in a bad way too. And really the problem is responsibility, a great deal of responsibility without proper use of the brain. And it was taking its toll not only on me but on these men as well. Well now, the aim of time management techniques are very simple. They are, first of all, to enable us to be more creative. Secondly, to improve our memory. Thirdly, to avoid tiredness and stress. And this is tremendously important. And you'll see it as it develops. Next, to help towards better sleeping patterns. Next, to help relaxation. Next, to give an overview of your work. Next, to introduce more self-discipline. And finally, to improve communications with colleagues. And by understanding the brain, we work towards all of these. Now, I'll gabble through the next bit because I think it'll be old hat to some of you. And it's a little bit about the brain as tape recorder. You'll know that Penfield in 1951, a surgeon doing operations on the brain by means of galvanic probes and electric shock, made a discovery about the brain through surgical work that, in fact, the brain records and is a vast library of various tapes. And so you've got the transactional analysis. Jeff Dixon has given us one or two talks on transactional analysis, I think it was about 4 years ago, and there's the parent-adult-child recordings. Parent recordings, prejudice, advice, controlling, authoritarian, helpful, loving, and so on. Adult recording of facts, actions and words that are analytical and well-founded, and child recordings, feelings, happy as well as aggressive, and there's various aspects to that. However, what they were interested in was another set of recordings that you may not have heard of, and that is the winner-loser tapes. And I'll just read them through, the contrasts. The winner recording in your mind comes out and says, "Oh, now I must look into that." The loser says, "No one knows anything about that." The winner says, "Yes, I will," or "No, I can't do that." The loser says, "Well, maybe I'm not sure," and can't make up his mind. The winner says, "I'll make time to do that." The loser says, "Oh, I never have time to do that." The winner says, "I'm sorry, I haven't made myself clear. Let me put that another way." The loser says, "You've misunderstood me." The winner says, "We seem to have differing opinions." The loser says, "I'm entitled to my opinion, aren't I?" The winner says, "Here's someone I can learn from." The loser says, "That person thinks he knows everything." The winner says, "Now there may be a better way or another way to tackle this." The loser says, "This is the way we've always done it." Well, you can hear some of your Kirk Sessions in that, can't you? Now, it's very easy to slip into the position of playing back loser tapes all the time. Take the problem of the driver, as an example, who overtakes you on the motorway on the wrong side. When you're harassed and under stress, it's very easy to react angrily and say, "If there weren't so many idiots on the road, I wouldn't get so harassed." But you're not harassed because there are idiots on the road. It's within yourself. Transfer that to a Kirk Session that's being very obstructive. You own that problem, particularly in your early years. That is your problem, no one else's. It's yours, whoever you're going to consult. You own the problem. And either you can see the Kirk Session as to blame, or you can see it the other way round and say, "I am the leader here, I am in charge, and I have to tackle this and to work through it. It's your problem. And you're going to work at it over 1 week, 100 weeks, 1,000 weeks. But it's your problem." Then there is the left-hand side of the brain and the right-hand side of the brain. Do you all know about this?
No.
Two sides of the brain, and this has been established really just in the 1970s. You'll all know how when a stroke's on one side, movement's affected, and when it's on the other side, speech is affected. You've seen that. Well, working from there, a tremendous amount has been discovered. The left hemisphere of the brain controls the right-hand side of the body. It deals with inputs one at a time. It deals with information in a logical order. It controls verbal expression, grammar, order of words, mathematical information. It has a special memory for words and numbers. It analyzes, evaluates, criticizes, and it's what we call common sense. The right hemisphere of the brain controls the left side of the body. It thinks in pictures, it visualizes, it connects things up in a new way. It deals with wholes and not with little details. It controls body expression, movement, sport. It has a special memory for faces and experiences and objects. It controls artistic work, music, intuition, spontaneity, and feelings. Now, the problem with so much of our education is that it has concentrated on the left-hand side and has neglected the right-hand side of the brain. Einstein possessed a complete balance. We might have thought that the great discoveries that came to him in the theory of relativity would have come to him while he was working in his lab or at his desk. But in fact, he tells us that the theory of relativity came to him while he was lying on a grassy hillside one summer afternoon with his eyes half closed. And the sunlight was playing on his lids, and he was playing with the sunlight, and he began imagining what it would be like to be traveling on a ray of sunlight. And he went on a kind of fantasy journey on a ray of sunlight, and then it was he got the theory of relativity. Leonardo da Vinci was the same. He developed both sides of the brain, and so his artistic work on the right-hand side and his inventions on the left-hand side, both operating together. It has to be a consciousness of both parts and the deliberate effort to use both parts that is going to help towards the greater use of our brain in our work. And influenced and helped will be creativity, solving problems, faster learning, improved memory, reading body language, better communications. You'll notice that the effort of time management has to develop the right side of the brain. Now, a wee bit about the way in which our minds are thought to operate, and there's enough common agreement on these three areas for fairly firm theories to be based on them. Basically three parts: conscious, unconscious, and preconscious. Now, it's known that people trying to communicate in a language they don't know tire very, very quickly. And the reason for that is that the conscious mind finds it easiest to deal with one thought at a time. And if you're speaking in a language that you don't know very well, obviously you're having to work your mind and deal with two thoughts at a time. What is it in French? What is it in English? When other thoughts are pressed in, then the conscious mind becomes very tired and stressed. And you're trying to spend time with your family in the evening, and at the same time naggling away at the back of your mind something you should have done yesterday and something you should do tomorrow, and you have a whole lot of other things you have to remember, and the result is you have a shallow sleep that night and you haven't relaxed. Does that ring bells, or is it just me? The secret of time management will begin with learning to deal with one thing at a time and to give that one thing one's whole problem one's whole attention. Secondly, there is one's preconscious mind. Now, when trained, the preconscious mind can operate efficiently in a certain number of given areas. It can be trained to operate, one might say, almost automatically. And here's an interesting thing, and you who've done psychology will know this. The magic number is 7. Your mind can be trained to work automatically in 7 areas, and for some odd reason, plus or minus 2. 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. But the magic number is 7. And I'll be saying a little bit more about this in a moment. The unconscious mind, the third level, is working all the time, even during sleep. Dreams, fantasies, prejudices, all the processes for creating new ideas operate within the unconscious mind, and it can be compared to a massive storage system from which data has to be obtained one item at a time. Skills which have been learned and which we use through our preconscious mind can be stored away in the unconscious and used from there without our being conscious of this. The most obvious example of this is driving a car. The preconscious masters the car driving skills and operates the vehicle efficiently, but the time comes when the conscious mind can be dealing with some problem and hands over entirely to the unconscious to look after driving the car, so that you arrive home wondering, oh, how did I get here? And you've been concentrating on something else entirely. Now, our question is, how do the conscious and the unconscious work together? And there are two illustrations given by the psychologists. The first illustration is of a volcano. The unconscious mind is like a volcano with a huge mixture of dreams, emotions, skills, facts, faces, data of all descriptions, creative ideas, all there. Every now and then, some of these blocks of lava come to the top of the crater into the conscious mind. The second illustration, you can imagine how vast that is. If you just think of all the places you've been to, and you can remember all the books you've read, the O-grades, the A-levels, the university degrees, the music that you know, the pictures you've seen, the people you know, the faces, it's all stored there in the brain. 10 billion cells in the brain, more than three times the number of people on the Earth's surface. Now, the other example of the mind is of a three-story building with a basement, and then there's the next floor, which is the preconscious, and then there's the top floor. And what you need to be able to do is to store things in an orderly manner so that you can pull them up and know where to get them at the right time. It's estimated now that 1,000 items per second can be fed into the mind every single minute of every single day, 24 hours a day, for 80 years, and there is still storage space left. And incidentally, I find that one of the most powerful arguments I've ever come across against evolution. Because it's now estimated that the most use that any of us normally gets out of our brain is 0.1%. It used to be thought 10%, but it's now thought 0.1% is the only use we get of the brain. Now, that just drives a horse and carriage through the evolutionary theory. We're way down there. God's given us something. And I think through sin and the fall, we have lost out how to use it. How evolution can square up with that, I do not know. It just, my mind boggles at it. But now, the situation of the volcanic eruption. Let's transfer it to the study. Well, you're studying, it's Wednesday morning and you're studying for your Sunday morning sermon. The phone rings. It's the beadle with some silly story about a radiator in the hall, and he goes on at great length about this, and you interrupt him really in a rather bad-mannered way and tell him to contact the plumber. And then your wife comes in with a distressing story about Jeannie's music teacher and a row that's brewing in the school over the instrument at home on loan to her. And there's been some jealousies and silly accusations are being made, and you try and soothe her and you promise that you will look into it in the afternoon. And then you remember you should have written a letter. And you should have phoned so-and-so, and while you're rummaging in the pile that you call your pending file, you come across another matter. Dash it, and you take that out and you put it up there where you'll remember it, and as you turn it floats down and you stand on it. Is that just me? And then you get back to your sermon, and after half an hour you discover that it's just been that volcano. And you've been going over, not reading about Obadiah at all, you've been going over about how you cut off the beadle on the phone, and or your wife, and you were impatient with her, and that stupid, stupid school, and those silly parents, and half a dozen other things, and you are controlled by a volcanic eruption in your consciousness. Now, time management is intended to rid you of that. It's intended to get rid of the volcanic eruption relationship between the conscious and the unconscious, and to make that relationship more akin to this busy warehouse scene. Controlled manner, orderly and controlled, making the maximum use of the basement storage. Full use of the in-connecting preconscious so that the second floor can operate steadily and efficiently. Now, very quickly, a word about the vast potential of the brain. I've said that it's reckoned now that only 0.1% of our brain's full potential is used. It was also widely believed that the brain reached its peak in the early 20s and then from then on deteriorated. Have any of you heard of that? Well, apparently that is total rubbish. Total rubbish. The brain can, if you keep yourself reasonably fit, the brain can continue to develop until the age of 80. And there is a most impressive list of documentation in this book that I have here somewhere. My there. You're not going to stop me.
That's a shame, because it was there because he showed it to me.
Right. There's a most impressive list of writers and artists and inventors whose major work was done after the age of 70. Very, very interesting indeed. And if our brains do slow up, and the people that we visit, their brains slow up, it's through stagnation. You have to keep your brain going all the time. Now, how can you keep your brain going all the time? There are, in fact, four basic rules. Incidentally, that was analytical thinking on the left-hand side, and that was synthetic, dealing in wholes, dealing in parts. The brain needs exercise. Now, I remember Jeff Dixon telling us way back in the early 1970s that we should walk 20 minutes a day. You don't need anything drastic like squash. If you take up squash at my age, you'll drop dead. 20 minutes walk a day. Apparently, a survey was done of people in further education colleges in Canada over a six-year period, and some were asked to take no exercise at all, just live flabby lives, and about 300 were asked to take regular, though not excessive, exercise, and the performance was significantly greater from those who were regularly exercising. And it's now known medically anyway that the cells need oxygenization all the time, so you should walk 20 minutes a day. Then diet, apparently, is very important, and you should use wholemeal foods where possible, vitamins, fresh fruit and vegetables, occasionally the vegetables being uncooked, as in salads. You need proper rest and relaxation. Your brain can grow tired. I noticed in the afternoon session yesterday that Mr. Still did absolutely the right thing. He said, take a break. On this time management course, we worked in 50-minute blocks. And then every 50 minutes, he had a wee alarm, and it bleeped, and we stopped for exactly 5 minutes, got up, walked around. When I came home at the end of the second day, Lorna said to me, I'm astounded. I thought that on a concentrated course from 9 till 5 through 2 days, you would be wrung out. You're absolutely fresh. And you know, I was completely fresh and relaxed. And I think it was because of the 50-minute blocks, as well as the way in which he was communicating. Then you need stimulation. Now, not the kind of stimulation you get from watching television. That is absolutely hopeless. That does nothing for your brain at all. The thing that, and obviously some programs are educative, but what I mean is, that the kind of experience you need is the difference between watching a football match and playing the football match. You've got to be in there, meeting the people, involved in things, for your brain to be developing. I was listening on my car radio travelling up from Larbert this morning, the Roy Plumley Desert Island Discs thing, and a woman was being interviewed, and she said her father was an army general and travelled all over the world with the British Army in these days, Victorian days, and he made it a hobby of learning languages, and he learned fluently 27 languages. I thought, great, that's it. He kept on learning them till his 80s, went to China and learned Chinese. Now, how do we apply all this that we've looked... Oh, no, here's a wee thing that I wanted to show you. No, I'll come to that. How do we apply all this to this time management technique? This thing, this visual aid, is called the funnel. and it begins with all the work we have to do, and it must include family life. You can't separate off your family life from the work that you're doing, as far as your diary is concerned. Now, George was speaking yesterday about displeasing God by not giving our wives time, and mea culpa. I am guilty of that and have been down the years. I confess it to my shame. And so when one is applying oneself to trying to organize one's time, wife and children and family are included. So what we had to do right at the beginning of the course was try and set down all the things we had to do. Cover a piece of paper with everything you have to do right throughout the whole year, all your work, your wife, your family, holidays, Saturday mornings with the children, teaching your teenagers to drive, everything in, and these are all your goals. So you begin there. Now, how do we work out our timetable, and how do we get all this into the we think the bottom, which I have forgotten, which is, what do I do this morning? What am I going to do this morning? It's a funnel, you see, and everything is channeled down to what I'm doing today. How do we work it? Well, first of all, there was that magic number 7, plus or minus 2. And we can train our minds to operate almost automatically in these key areas, they're called. 9 key areas. Now, I want to say a wee bit about the key areas, because this has been a revelation to me, and I found it most useful. Just imagine, I've been teaching 2 of my children to learn to drive. Just imagine that the dashboard of the car was like that. Now, in fact, I've thought of every single control in my British Leyland Allegro, and I've just thrown them onto the dashboard. Now, any of you, your work a wee bit like that? Particularly when you start just thrown. It was a revelation for me to discover that all modern cars now have their controls arranged in sevens. You have the steering column, the things on either side, 2, you have the dials, 3, the gear lever, 4, the foot pedals, 5, the switches here, 6, and the mirror, 7. We were shown, actually, not a car, but all the controls of the Concorde, and they reach from the floor right overhead, and they're all divided into 7. And that is because your mind can learn to operate in 7. As I say, you drive home and then you wonder, how did I get here? And you've been concentrating on something else or having a conversation with someone else, and you don't have to bother about changing gear or slowing up at the traffic lights. You just do it automatically. You've trained yourself to do it. Now, what we have to do then is to take our work and to divide it into 7 key areas, and to use the plus 2 for personal development and family matters. That's the first step. And those 7 key areas must be areas that cover absolutely everything, leaving nothing out at all. Now, I confess that the first manny there was me. It really was. I tried to be organised, but I'd never got things categorised like this. The illustration that Time Manager uses, first of all, the trunk of the tree is you. You and your brain, your goals for your work, and surely we know what it is we have to do. We've been hearing so much about it. You know where you are going. That's the trunk. Then the branches, 7 plus or minus 2, are the key areas of your living through which you will move towards your goals. And then the twigs, are the various tasks or elements of your key areas. Now, then there are the pine needles, which are all the various attributes of that to build up the picture of the Christmas tree. This is a Scandinavian product, and hence the illustration of the Christmas tree, I think. Now, it took me actually several days to work on this and to work it out. And these are the key areas that I have worked out for my ministry. Now, it may be not applicable to some of you at all, but I've got people. That includes my session clerk, my organist, the cleaners, all my, the conveners of the various Kirk session committees, all the people that I have contact with week by week. Then there's my preparation. Preparation for Sundays, for midweek, for various other speaking engagements. Then committees. We are doomed to serve on committees, some of us. Then there are projects. Then there are organizations within the church. The youth organizations, the women's organizations, and so on. I've got a plethora of those. Then there's administration. I think all of us are involved in administration. And then finally, visitation. There's no order of importance there. It's... Pardon? Oh, I love wee projects, Sandy. I've always got a project on the go. I think it's good for me. We've got a hydroelectric scheme project at the moment. See, the Carron runs through our glebe. Well, we didn't own it, but I persuaded the general trustees to buy it, and the old mill laid, and so we're planning a powerhouse here. Mind you, it's all been a little bit set back in that a local farmer bulldozed part of the weir down to try and lower the level of the river. Then I wanted to bring Robert Bruce's gravestone in from the graveyard where it was deteriorating. 1631, it was put there. No, the reformer successor to Andrew Melville at the High Kirk in Edinburgh. I wanted to bring it into the church, and I had to write to Lord Elgin, Lord Thurlow, the local planning authority, general trustees, and I made that a project. And I did that myself, and we've got it brought in now and got Manpower Services Commission to do the work, so it was all done for nothing. That's the kind of project that David Searle happens to like, you know. I've always got something on. Oh, yes. I got any questions to come to Larbert, just as a sort of community event. I felt very guilty when George was speaking yesterday, saying other things are doing and you ought not to be doing. I thought, oh, any questions, especially the way Nicky Fairbairn was dressed, it was ridiculous. So I don't know, maybe you don't go in for projects. No, you don't.
David, could I ask, you seem to have left personal development and family to chance. The optimum number is 7, and if you're able to cope with more, then personal development...
No, the optimum number isn't 7. 9 is the optimum number.
Right.
7 is the comfortable number. But they, I mean, this is their suggestion. And you see, the diary has in fact 9 key areas. This is the time manager diary. And it has 9 key areas at the heart of it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'll be showing you it a wee bit more fully. And it's their suggestion in their manual that 8 and 9 are reserved for personal development and family. And I might say everything goes into here, or summaries of every single thing. Pads and little bits of paper and notebooks and jottings are out. You get rid of them completely. You have everything in there. Yes. No, I said it's not in any order of priority.
And it's nothing to do with capacity. I got the impression when you were speaking that the optimum number being 7 plus or minus two. You might have five in your capacity, or someone else might have nine in their capacity.
I don't know the answer to that. I think you'd have to ask some psychologists present. There is a whole section in Peter Russell's brain book on the magic number seven. And the preconscious, and I've read it, and he didn't say whether it was an optimum or a minimum or capacity.
If your capacity was five and you set out to do nine, then you're going to be in a bigger mess than you were before you started nine.
Yes, no, I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. I was very interested in Jim Robertson speaking about people who were thick as two planks. I have seen folk who are like that converted and their minds and brains beginning to grow, you know. I remember one boy at New Hills who came from a children's home, was adopted and so on, and really you would have thought he was remedial, and he was gloriously converted, and he began reading C.S. Lewis. And he read and he read and he read, and he upped his IQ, I'm quite sure, and it used to be thought that your IQ you were born with and you couldn't up it. You can up your IQ by developing your brain. However, we're speaking about tidiness just now, and then we come on to the twigs, the tasks or the elements. And I've got here an example from my time manager of number six, which was administration. And these are the various things that I've got. Under number 6, you then code everything, 6-1, 6-2, 6-3, 6-4. And on the front page, you have an index of what you've got. And then you have all these pages. You know exactly where to go. Anything to do with the Kirk session goes there, elders districts and the role and correspondence and so on, right down. Funerals are all put as they occur. As I enter them up in my diary, I flick over, I know it's 6-6. Whether that's anything, there's any significance in that or not, I don't know. Six is the number of man, isn't it? It just happens to have worked out that it's 6-6. I go to that and I know automatically, 6-6 funerals. I'm beginning to learn it. The pine needles, I've only time to give you one example of the various subdivisions that go on here. And I've worked one out for you. I suspect that I should be taking things off this funnel here to complete the picture. Oh no, here we are. Activities. I might say I'm trying to compress into a very short time two very full days. And you'll be glad to know that I'm well over three quarters way through. Activities. Now, the activity is the Sunday school picnic. And in both my charges, in the first three or four years, I had to be in on the organising of this. It was a shambles before I went. And I wanted it to go well. I wanted it to be a good event for the congregation. And so I sat in with the Sunday school teachers. Now, the idea of what you do here is you've got this page, you see, under, for me, organisations are five, Sunday school is number five. So under 5-5, I insert another page, and it's number one, the activity is Sunday school picnic. And you make a list, or the committee makes a list, of all the things that have to be done. It might run to about 20. I've just jotted down one or two here. You've got to book the park. We're going to Alva. You have to get prices for the tea from the local baker. You have to get the sports equipment. You have to book buses. You have to get tickets printed. You need a letter to the parents and so on. The list goes on. You write down in initials beside it who you are delegating that to. Robin Coulter's going to book that. Anne Ballantyne, not the minister at ERF, but a Sunday school teacher of ours, is going to see the baker. Bob Williams is going to go along to the school and borrow the sports equipment and see about that. Robin Coulter will see to the buses. Fiona Barrowman is going to print the tickets. And Edna Morrow will draw up the letters for the parents and so on. So you put these down. Now, that is supposed to indicate how long the task will take, duration, when they ought to start, when they should be well on the way, and the deadline. And you're working towards the month, say, of May, when the picnic is. So you put in these dates, and then you make cross entries in your diary. Now, this meeting took place in September. We were a year ahead. I put down 10:83, and in my diary I entered up 5:11 on a certain day. And when that day came, in the evening, when I came to make my telephone calls, I telephoned Robin and said, have you booked the park? Oh no, I've forgotten to do that. You'll be doing it, won't you? And then a week later, following the entry again, progress. How's it going? Have you got the park booked? And you sit at the phone, and in 5 minutes, you've covered the whole lot at the dates when they need to be attended to. They're astounded at the efficiency. So are you. Now, colour coding. The right-hand side of the brain deals in colours, the left-hand side in letters, in literacy. Now, you need both sides of the brain. God has given us both sides. So you use the right-hand side of your brain in planning your diary. Why? Two major reasons. Colours strike you immediately. Secondly, an overview of what you're doing is absolutely critical. Now, time management is all against the week-by-week diary. All against. Absolutely hopeless. You don't get an overview. And so the diary system that we have here gives, in fact, a breakdown of day, week, month, and year. And you can see them all at once. First of all, in here, I'd better come to the front, you've got a personal directory, addresses and telephone numbers at the front. You carry your time manager with you everywhere. It sits on your bed. It sits beside your bed at night because it's when you relax that you remember things you have to do. And you can't go to sleep saying, now, I must remember in the morning there's four things. You can't do that. So you switch on the light, you take out the pen and you write down those four things and they're off your mind. That's just simple and basic. I was at the Scripture Union conference in St. Ninian's last week in Crete, and a relative died. And the relative who was in our growth, the relative who phoned me, I had to make the funeral arrangements, said, I'm trying to let everyone know that I haven't got so-and-so's address, A, B, C, D, and D. Now, I carry this everywhere with me. I said, he said, could you, when you get home tomorrow, could you let me have them? I said, no, I'll give you them now. Up. Flicked through, gave the telephone numbers straight. Oh, thanks very much. It's great, everything's there. Now, the diary gives you a monthly view. That's January. And it's 18 months at a time. It goes on to June 1985. Then here, you've got the week. I've been at Crete, partly on holiday, so you see it's nicely blank. Then you've got each day. That is Wednesday, that was Wednesday, and the idea is that as the day passes, you just tap it in there, and you're on to the next day. And then you get, so you've got, this slides out. So you've got the month, the week, the day, and then there's a space here for annual schedules. Those are holidays. We have a deaconess and an assistant, and you've got to be very punctilious about working out the holidays a year ahead. And then those are outside engagements, and I can see them all at once. They're in green here. So that you're not caught hopping. You open your monthly diary or your annual diary and you see exactly where you're going, where you need to be, ahead, and therefore you can plan. It's all down there. Now, how to drive your desk. Dash it. That's something I've forgotten to bring. I have a file in seven divisions. My desk used to be exactly like, in fact, it really was a scandal. I was ashamed of it. I remember I was over in Belfast, and I was in, they've got masses of Christian bookshops in Belfast, and one of them had lots of these posters, and I saw this lovely picture of three pigs in the mud, you know, peering through a barbed wire netting fence, and underneath was the caption, "It's my mess and I like it." And that so endeared itself to me that I bought it, you see, for 30 pence and put it up on the door inside my study. And when people came in and looked round, I said, "Look," by way of apology. I now have a completely clear desk, and the difference it has made to me is enormous. Now, there's a very simple device of having a clear desk. It's that pending file, you see. A cluttered desk caused the death of Dick Burke. He was thumbing through his pending file. That's a euphemism for a great pile of materials cluttering a couple of trays. When he came across, one after another, during the course of 10 minutes, bills, invoices, letters, memos dating back 7 months unattended to. And these began to be littered around him, and he put one up here and one over there and one here where I'll not forget it. And then as he reached the bottom of the pile, the rest fell on him and he died of shock. I once had to telephone round 9 ministers in our presbytery to arrange a meeting. Only 2 knew where their diaries were. And out of those 2, one forgot to put the entry in his diary. The others, oh, it's in the boot of the car. Someone else, and you could hear the rustling. It's underneath here somewhere. Someone, oh, I've got it. It's fallen down the back. This is true. It's chaos. Well, how do you drive your desk? I have a series now of 7 trays, and you can easily buy them for a pound or 2. The top one is today, and the only things that go in there are dealt with today. The second one is soon, and you review that every morning at 8:45. If you get into your study by 9 o'clock, you make it 15 minutes early, and you review that soon every morning. You filter through everything in it, and what has to be dealt with today, you put in the today, and you don't go to bed until it's done. The next tray is read, and you make entries in your diary when you are going to read. An hour, I'm going to read. Another tray, the next one, is pass on. We all get stuff to pass on. The great problem of every presbytery is the bottleneck of the minister. You know, you can't get stuff past the minister. You send it to him, and poor man, why should people send us stuff to pass on? Well, you need to organise what you have to pass on, so you have a tray, pass on. The next one is waiting more information, and the 7th one is to be typed. So you've categorised it all, and when the mail comes in the morning, you spend... That's only 6. No, today, soon, read, file, oh, I missed out, file, to be filed, pass on, waiting more information and to be typed, and wonder of wonders, the desk is kept clear. My magazine editor is a very sort of high-powered businessman. He's manager of Bowater for Scotland, an honours graduate from Oxford, and he used to be appalled coming to my study. And when I told him I was going on this course, he said, "David, so what mugs people are. Fancy being taken in by that. Just rubbish." A month later he came in and said, "I'm very impressed." Now, my last topic that we dealt with, wait, I should have finished this off. You time, you book the time, and you make the time, and you have the overview. And so that answers the question of what do I do today. The whole thing is worked out. I've got last year's diary here to show you. December, you know what December is like. The bits you can see that are shaded in, that is in my study. And that is only disturbed for funerals. And managers are told you mustn't work an open door. policy. It's disastrous. There are certain times when you are not disturbed for anything. And I think in the ministry that is very important. It's very difficult. And think of how little peace some of us give Mr. Steele, phoning him up at every time of the day and night, wanting to speak to him. But I've got colour codes there. Everything is worked out. It's reviewed every night, 5 minutes before I go to bed. I sit down, before I lock up, put the milk bottles out. I sit down and look through it and transfer from the various codings. There's all kinds of codings here, 6, 7, 11, 15, 3, 5, 4, 9. And they all refer to my work, and I look through, enter them up on the day's program and the week's program. And so the thing goes like clockwork. It really does. Now, the last subject is relationships.
Can you just tell us what overview means? Is that what you've just described?
Overview is what I've just described. You see the whole thing. You see the month and the year. People are cottoning onto this. I mean, OMF, Pocket Testament League, they give you wall planners. And they're enormously useful, but you have to work them. You have to work at it, and it's just a few minutes each day. Now, another of the subjects that we dealt with seven, and I've really only picked out three to share with you, was relationships, strokes. Now, those of you who've done psychology will know about strokes. A stroke is the psychologist's word for positive encouragement. Your wife needs attention. Without it, she languishes. Your session clerk, believe it or not, needs attention. Without it, he languishes too. Without this interaction, people become mentally deranged. Now, I'm chaplain of the Central Region's Mental Hospital, Psychiatric Hospital, and I can tell you that last year there was an average of 10 overdoses a week. And 9 out of those 10, on average, were women abandoned by their husbands, cut off, alone, isolated from the community. And the psychiatrists say that it's no longer stress or business or too much to do that causes mental breakdown, but no interaction. That's what brings people to take overdoses in 1984. We need strokes, we need encouragements. Now, I wish educationalists would learn this. You know, people need encouragement to motivate them to achieve results. And what we are accustomed to getting is encouragement if we achieve the results. And I have a son who suffered very, very badly, I'm quite sure. In this particular respect, he went to our local comprehensive school, and it was the policy of discipline was if it moves, shoot it, you know, if it moves, belt it. And he really languished. And then he went to Edinburgh University, and he got a lecturer who began by saying, "You're a very intelligent young man." He's given his best to him. Absolute best. Encouragement produces results, and then you commend and encourage. So people need strokes. Yes, it's a technical word. Some of you done psychology, and you recognise the word, a stroke. It doesn't imply physical touch at all, though it may. We were told of an experiment that had been done. A woman deliberately left, say, 60 or 70 pence in 10 pences in a telephone kiosk, and observers stood by, and they waited until men went in. And they saw the money and put it in their pocket, and then she went up to them and said, "By the way, you didn't see money in there." Oh no. 18 were interviewed, and only one said, "Oh yes, was that yours?" They then went through the whole exercise again, and this time, when she asked them, she put her hand on their arm, and 17 out of the 18 gave her hand. Now, Dennis Westfield. Yes, Dennis Westfield, who's the chief psychiatrist at Belsdyke, says to me that they don't understand why, but if when they're counselling they just put a hand on the arm, they bypass guilt. They don't know how. I'd be interested to know what Mary thinks of this. Just a hand on the arm, that's all. And you bypass guilt, And they'll start telling you all kinds of things that they didn't tell you before. Now, I was listening to a hard-headed businessman talking before he came into Time Manager. He was the sales director for Chrysler. Now, that's pretty near the top. And do you know what he said? He said, you'll never motivate your subordinates to work hard for you unless you encourage them and are friendly with them sincerely. He said, unless you're 100% sincere without their realizing it, your colleagues will sense your insincerity. They'll pick up from you the way you speak and from your body language your lack of sincerity. And you'll not get from them optimum work. Now, the firms, you know, that use this, a very impressive list, AA, Ashridge Management College, BASF, Bank of America, Blue Circle, British Airways, British Gas, British Institute of Management, Burroughs, CEGB, Conoco, Commodore, Data General, Equity and Law, ESSO, Henley Management, Hewlett-Packard, ICI, IBM, Holiday Inns, National Coal Board, and so on. I'm only a third way down the list. So we're not dealing with something which is just a money spinner, someone ringing your doorbell. This is well established now. Won the export order for Denmark last year, Time Management. We were given three guidelines to begin working on in relationships at work, and these have given me enormous food for thought, a whole new world. First, the first 4 minutes when you meet someone. Now, this was hammered into us. We were told that it will take possibly 10 years to alter the impression that you create in the first 4 minutes you meet someone. In that first 4 minutes, you create impressions by your words, by your dress, by your manner, by the way you speak, by your body language, that will be the foundation of your future relationship. And if it was a bad day for you and you were sharp or rude, then you'll have a massive job, years and years and years, to live it down. Then the way that you say what you say, quite simply, and again, I tell you, it wasn't ministers that were being addressed, it was managers. Quite simply, your inner soul is being transmitted subconsciously. And either that you're sincere and genuine and to be trusted, or that you're just interested in this person for any way they might be useful to you, and you're a rotter, all that will be transmitted. And thirdly, your body language, what your smile and your mouth and your hands and your eyes and your head and the way you stand, what it all conveys. What do you think of this? We speak about preaching. I wonder if you can swallow this. We were told that in our communicating, 7% is what you say, 38% the way you say it, and 55% your body language. Now, I found that, as a minister of the word, very, very interesting and very challenging. And it so happened that the week after I'd been on this course, we were going in the evenings through 1 Thessalonians 2, and I'd come to 1 Thessalonians 2, the first 12 verses, and I discovered here that Paul knew all that. He knew it all. He says, our appeal did not spring from error or from impure motives. He's onto body language straight away. And if you look up Howard Marshall, he says, it's trying to exploit someone sexually that Paul means. Now, the world knows all about this, the way a man addresses a woman, the way a woman addresses a man. And they know perfectly well, instinctively, what is in your heart when you're speaking to them. And Paul says, our appeal didn't spring from impure motives, nor did it appeal from trying to trick you. We weren't trying to con you, we were absolutely sincere. The appeal we make, on the contrary, we speak as men approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, and we're not trying to please men, but God who tests our hearts. And he says that he began with tremendous courage, After all, he'd just come from Philippi, hadn't he? And by today's standards, he would have needed hospital treatment for his back in case it turned to septicemia. But there he was, having been beaten to within an inch of his life, and he was proclaiming the gospel again. And all that courage came out, and yet beside that rugged courage in the man, he says, "We were like a mother as she cares for her children among you." And I thought, well, I'm not sure that I agree with their estimate, but I can see how these things are tremendously important. And, you know, I make a wee confession to you. I don't think George Phillips here, is he? He's gone. Well, that's good. I can speak a wee bit more freely. I was watching yesterday when he was preaching, and I was tremendously blessed. And I thought, now, George, yes, it's what you're saying, but it's the way you're saying it. And it's the way you're standing. You're giving your soul to us. Yes. Lloyd Jones says the same in Preaching and Preachers. Don't be hidden by a pulpit. You preach with your body, he says. Mm-hmm. Well, I was tremendously blessed, and I remember something that I read years ago. When a vacancy committee go to hear someone preaching, they don't hear a sermon; they hear a man. I remember reading that McChain said, "God uses our likeness to Jesus more than all our talents." So he knew about it too. So what these chaps are just discovering is something that the Bible has had embedded in it as part of it from time immemorial. Now, how can I... Oh yes, no, I said there were only three. We were given three guidelines. The first 4 minutes, the way you say what you say, and the body language. Now, I want to try and sum all this up. Planning the night before, oh yes, there was one other thing I wanted to show you. Apparently someone has discovered after years of research that with most people, professional people, 20% of their time produces 80% of the results, and 80% of the time produces 20% of the time, the results. And what time management wants to do is to try and extend that up there so that very unproductive 80% of our time becomes much more productive. Now, Andrew, my brother-in-law, told me that IBM have done a great deal of work on this. They're a very aggressive firm, a very successful firm, one of the most successful firms in the world today, and they have monitored very closely all the money they've been putting into time management, and they reckon it takes a year to get into this way of operating. It's like learning to drive. You have to get these seven areas fixed in your mind. You have to get your whole filing system geared to them, and I'm reorganizing my own filing system to be geared to the seven key areas. But they have worked out that they get another day per week from those who learn time management, an increase of 20% in time available for productive work. Now, I think I've just three wee things to say to finish with. And the first is to say I have found this very, very helpful, just introducing order into my life. That's the first thing. The second thing is, Mr. Still quoted Ernest Kevin, who was my teacher for 2 years. Ernest Kevin didn't like the hymn, "Lord, in the fullness of my might, I would for thee be strong." He thought that that was a little presumptuous, that all service was of grace and so on, and I've thought a lot about that, but I still choose the hymn. And I think if one puts it in its proper theological context, it's a good hymn. And I would say that, "Lord, in the fullness of anything that you have given me, I do want to be strong. I do want to use all my time. All my time." I'm 46 now, And I've spent 20 years over two churches, and I'm halfway through, by normal reckoning, if God spares me. And the older one gets, the more one wants to use every single minute for God, every minute for him. Only one life, and soon it will be past, and only what's done for Jesus will last. And the third thing that I learnt from this, I think also very important, was to be pictorial in my preaching. It's this right-hand side of the brain and the left-hand side. Now, we have to hold them both in balance. And again, listening to George yesterday, there was lots of imagery in it. And I think some of us are too conceptual in our preaching. Now, we have to be conceptual. Of course we do. The gospel is in concepts. But people remember pictures. I gave to my session clerk and Sunday school superintendent and treasurer a little selection of Spurgeon that's come into the bookshops recently. It's a couple of pounds. And I was reading it through before I was parcelling them up, and it was full of pictorial images. He said, I love the man who said, reading the Bible is like eating fish. Every so often you come across a bone. But you don't neglect the fish. You just lay the bone carefully to one side and you carry on. Pardon? Oh, Booth said that. Oh, well, maybe Spurgeon got it from Booth or Booth got it from Spurgeon. But that's just one wee example. His language is tremendously pictorial and you can communicate that way. Who was the most pictorial teacher of all? And yet, look at some of our sermons sometimes. You know, if pictures, word pictures, are like windows letting in the light, some of our sermons are a wee bit kind of prison-like, aren't they? People have said to me, and I finish with this remark, people have said to me again and again and again over the last 3 months, David Searle, what has happened to your preaching? And I would say two things have happened. I've been expressing myself a little bit more in pictures. I'm not saying I'm using illustrations all the time. I'm not doing that. I'm trying to be like the Lord. And if you look at Paul again in that passage in 2 Thessalonians, in 1 Thessalonians 2, the nurse and all the rest of it, the language in which he's using, I've been trying to do that, and I've been sleeping better. I'm needing an hour's less sleep. Now, you might not believe that, but that is as true as I am standing here. And I'm needing an hour's less sleep because I was such a shambles before. And I'm almost ashamed to admit it. Now, I was speaking to a minister just hours ago who belongs to this fellowship. And do you know what he admitted to me after all Mr. Still has said to us about rest and relaxation? That he'd gone 2.5 months without a day off. That's wrong. So that's time management. Apparently your efficiency goes like this. That's when you rise, and that's your lunch hour, that's your evening meal. And you should plan the vital tasks when you're at your peak, and you should use this time for incidental tasks, telephoning and so on.
I've said that so often to youngsters, students. You see, lot that I've written the rhythms of rest and work. They thought was for old folk, you see, who are in their last legs. But I've reminded them that our efficiency decreases as the day goes on, and if students say get up seven, eight in the morning, and they're going the whole time, classes, library, coffee rooms, and friends and so on, without any rest or relaxation at all. By half of their efficiency has decreased considerably, and by the end of the day, and the evening perhaps, when they're seeking to do their study, their efficiency has gone right down, and they're wasting their time. And I'm sure that's true. That's why I think the rhythms idea is very important. When one's reading, concentrating hard, or studying carefully, I wouldn't allow more than an hour Now, I'll be working sometimes from 5 until 8 before breakfast in the morning, but I wouldn't go on that whole time without doing something. Water the flowers or something, or do something, just get up and do something for 2 or 3 minutes, and then on again. It's a tremendous relief. And you end the day. If I'm up at 5, you see, I have half an hour, 3/4 an hour, between 2 and 3 in the afternoon, in bed, actually in bed, sometimes sleeping, you see. And you're fresh right up until 11 at least, or later. So I appreciate that. Thanks very much. Questions to the man until... for another 5 minutes.
Two quick questions, just practical points. First of all, can we all get one of these diaries and wear?
Yes, over on the table there, this is a Danish production, and it is expensive, and you can claim it on your income tax. And all the office equipment and so on that I have bought, I claim on my income tax. So you've got to remember, you're getting 30% back. I think that's right and proper. The British have produced one which UCCF commend, Filofax. This has been on the go for years and years. It's not quite the same thing, but I took the trouble to write to Filofax and to Time Management International. And over on the desk, don't, whatever you do, send off to Time Manager International an order form for Filofax, or vice versa. You'll be kind of crossing wires there.
David, can I say something?
But both of them are there, yes.
UCCF say that if you want to buy Filofax, buy it through UCCF, and that way they get a commission from Filofax. If you buy it direct, you'll just get it for the standard price. If you buy it through UCCF, it doesn't cost you any more, but UCCF get a commission. And I've got the name of the chapter right too.
I see, yes. Well, anyway, Filofax catalogues and price lists and order and time management are over there. Time management, there's things for courses there, and there's one in Glasgow in March, but you don't need to go on the course, quite honestly. You can buy the manual, and they encourage you to stick a photograph of yourself in the front wee window, you see, just stick it. So.
Coffee is served.
Can I just ask quickly, and I think it would be helpful too for us to think about and discuss how we avoid the interruptions, the bells and the
I couldn't give you everything. There are pages on this, interruptions, time stealers, pages on it. Uh-huh. Spent half a day on it.
Yes.